Welcome to today's Voices of Conservation Science. On this podcast, we talk to people that are doing science, and that science is then used to conserve natural resources. I'm your host, Andrea Litt. And my guest today is Jessica Harris. She's a graduate student in the Department of Ecology at Montana State University. Welcome, Jessica. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm excited about talking about your work and your path. And to get us started, why don't you just tell us a little bit about you?
Okay. So let's see. So I grew up in Michigan. So I'm from a small town on the west side of Michigan. There's maybe like 3,000 people or so there. And yeah, I loved growing up there. I'm super, super thankful that I grew up there just because grew up on the beach. I grew up in the woods, like I was in the woods, always like exploring in the forest and stuff as a kid. I loved like running and climbing the dunes and all that kind of stuff.
You grew up in a very cold beach. So I'm from Wisconsin. So I'm familiar with the beaches of Lake Michigan, which are not the sandy beaches of, say, Southern California or something like that. So when you say beach, are we talking rocky beach or sandy beach? And certainly colder, I'm guessing.
Okay. Yeah. So it's definitely colder compared to like California. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely sandy. People are always looking for rocks. So that's like one of my favorite things to do at the beach. In the summer though, it is warm. I mean, it can be like 90 degrees normally. So
and then you just got to get in that freezy Lake Michigan water. And
yes, you do have to brave it, but
so you're running, you're enjoying the outside and enjoying your backyard as a kid on that lake.
Yeah. Yep. That's basically how I spent all my time. Like I ran cross country and track growing up, biked everywhere. I used to go on like 50 mile bike rides.
Wow.
I still love to do that, but like that was my childhood basically. So, so really enjoyed growing up there. And then, after that, as a 17-year-old, I was like, man, I want to see the world. I want to get out of my small town. So then I moved to Chicago. I went to school at DePaul University. So that's, people know like Millennium Park. It's like 5 miles north of Millennium Park, if you're gotcha. Familiar.
And how big is, so obviously 3,000 person town you grew up in. You go to the big, big city of Chicago to see the world. How big is DePaul?
So I think DePaul has about, I think it's like 25,000 students, but
okay, so substantially bigger than your town.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, DePaul was really fun just because like the actual college itself is very small. It's like half a mile. By half a mile, honestly. So like the actual campus, a lot of the students are like commuters. So that's where like a lot of that big student body comes from. I did environmental science there. I got a minor in biology and in chemistry. I loved my environmental science community there. Like I'll shout it to the rooftops. I had a really good group of like colleagues and professors there, and everybody's like very close. So that was a really great part about DePaul.
How did you decide on that particular major? Was that something you always knew was going to be the avenue you would pursue for your career?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it was kind of one of those things where it was like, I can spend my life doing stuff for the environment. Like who knew? Like I'm going to do that. I think I actually saw like the like majors you could pick. And I was like, oh, environmental science. Like that sounds like a good thing for the world. I'm going to do that. I think before that though, honestly, I feel like in high school, I thought a lot more about like running and like being in theater and all that kind of stuff, that was like way more my focus, I think, in high school than like my career, to be honest.
So what do you think changed that what changed in your life that made you think, oh, this science thing, in particular this environmental science thing, is maybe more where I'm going to head?
So for me, and like, I've talked about this, you know, I feel like I talk about this all the time, but, and it's definitely cheesy, but nature has always been like my safe place. Like definitely like whether I'm happy or like I'm sad or like I'm angry. Like I would like going out to the forest would just always kind of like center me, I guess is a good way of saying it. And I know for me, it's kind of like that part of my life has always meant so much to me. And so if I could like spend my life, first off, like doing something to protect like this, like for me, like a spiritual entity or like, you know, nature, whatever you want to call it, if I could spend my life like learning about that and protecting it, like what else would, like that just seems like the natural thing to do, like for my life, because that means the most to me. And then I think just because of like how I grew up, like a lot of my time was just like exploring this. I live in the forest where I grew up, and like just exploring that and like identifying all the plants and like climbing all the trees and like physically interacting with my environment all the time. Like my natural environment, I think kind of was like the building blocks of like, oh, like if I do this, like what happens if like what organisms are here? If I lift this log, like why are there a bunch of like salamanders or like mushrooms underneath it? And a big part of that was my brother. My brother is also like a plant ecologist and microbiologist kind of person. So, yeah. So like for us, like going outside and like learning about like the biodiversity and being able to name plants and like seeing everything, I think in person really like, I don't know, created something in me that just like, I don't know, was connected. Like I just like love nature. So
yeah, it's so, really, you just said a lot of interesting things that, you know, at first I was thinking, well, if this is your safe space and your happy place, then, you know, for some people, the things that they do for enjoyment are not necessarily the things that they want to do for work, right? In some cases. And then the next thing you talked about is, you know, doing something that ensures that the maintenance of those safe spaces for you and for many other people for generations to come. And you go, okay, now I see where maybe the idea of integrating your recreation and your the thing that keeps you healthy and sane, then maybe starts to look more like something you can also do as a job for the sake of the protection part and the ensuring that it's around. But then you talked about this sort of curiosity thing of you and your, in your childhood and maybe with you and your brother of like, why are these things, particular things here? What happens if this change is made? And so I can see all these pieces coming together of not just having the forest or these wild spaces be a place of enjoyment, but be a place of fueling curiosity and wanting to protect all of those things. Did you know what your career might look like?
So I think, like thinking back to like who I was at 17, again, it was like a light bulb moment where I was like, oh, like I can do that. Like I never knew I could do that. So, just meaning like, I didn't know like I could study trees as like a job, like for real. And I don't think it was until I looked into college that was like, oh, this makes sense for me. like this is something I actually could do with my life. So
you mentioned your brother, and him being a plant ecologist. So I'm guessing he might've played a role in helping you. Is he, I don't know if he's younger or older, but maybe having somebody else in the family where you could see, that what this job might look like. Is that fair? I'm putting words in your mouth completely, but
no, you're not. Yeah, I think that's like something that's, I guess, like interesting as like my, for my family, I am like the first person, like first woman to be going to college. And like for my mom, I think, I don't know, I think it was like, it was real, it was kind of like a weird concept, like me going to college, I think, just because like girls in my family didn't go to college and stuff. So that was kind of a thing. And I think having my brother there, first off, is like a major influence. Like he's my older brother, so he's 5 years older. And it's like, oh, I love my brother. I look up to my brother. Like I'm sure that's how I was as a kid. But I think, yeah, like having him around, I mean, I think because it was something we did together, like we would always walk in the woods every day, like having that companion and older role model in a way, like to show you those things and to interact with nature with you, I think definitely played a huge role in like me wanting to do any of this stuff. So
were there other people that were really instrumental in helping you along your path?
So I think, yeah, like I think after college, like in college and after college for sure. I think in high school, mostly it was my brother and probably my dad, just because they both are like really, like they loved being outside and stuff. And then, yeah, like in college, I just got really lucky. Like I had really great, I had a really great advisor from the environmental science department. And his name is Liam Heenahan. I hope I'm saying his name right if he ever listens to this, but he's from Ireland. So he was my advisor. He's an amazing guy. I mean, he's so funny and he's very witty. He's like, he did zoology for his PhD. So now he studies basically like worms and decomposition processes. And he also is a writer. So he writes a lot of like environmental literature stuff, which is really cool. Like cool. He does it all. So, yeah. So he played a major role just because I think I don't know, like I know myself and I'm the kind of person who needs like a lot of encouragement. And he was a really good fit for me in that way, because he would always be like, oh, like, you don't have to say sorry for like asking questions. Like, it's good that you like, well, like want to know more and stuff. And like, he was always very, and like still is, he's still a part of my life. You know, because he'd always be like, you know, like being you is awesome. And like, you can really like, you know, do something like with this career and like with your life. And
that's terrific. That's really terrific.
Yeah. Yeah. He's super sweet. And I also worked at the Field Museum of Natural History during my undergrad. I worked there part-time. And then I worked there a little bit after I graduated, like during that transition phase. And I worked with Matt von Conrat, and he actually will probably listen to this.
So you're giving him a shout out right now.
Yep. So shout out to Matt. But yeah, Matt I've learned so much from Matt. Like he is from New Zealand. So another like worldly advisor.
Global mentors.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt is just like, he never stops making jokes. Like he's a jokester. And it was really funny because like my first day there, I was like, oh, like I have to be super serious. Like this is science. And then like the first time I met him, it was just like, just jokes all day long. And it was kind of funny. Like he just made it really fun. And what I did there was I worked in the herbarium. So that's basically like a library of plants from all over the world from different times. Like our oldest plant there was, I think was from Captain Cook's voyage in like 1773 or something like that.
Wow. Wow. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So I got to basically do like herbarium management and then digital imaging. So just taking pictures of specimens so that other museums can essentially like borrow them or people can borrow them for research purposes.
So they don't have to come to that particular collection. They can make use of the information from other places.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. And it's just great. Like if an herbarium, I mean, God forbid, like caught on fire, you would still have like all of that information. So that, and then I also worked on the bryophyte checklist for Cook County, which like hadn't ever been done. Yeah.
Can you tell us all what a bryophyte is? Oh,
thank you. Yeah.
You are welcome.
So bryophytes are mosses, liverworts, and hornworts. And basically they are the first, like, I guess you'd call them class of vascular land plants. So like after algae, you have bryophytes. And bryophytes are really cool just because they're super small. Like a leaf is literally like the size of an eyelash. So they're really useful as like bioindicators. And so some of the work, a bioindicator is basically, it'll give you information about like air quality, for instance, because they're so sensitive and so small that like if I have a moss and it's in a really polluted place, it might, you know, be one of the first plants to show, I guess, like a behavior or being affected by that air pollution, for example. So that was one of the questions, like one of the projects that I worked on was helping just do basically using a spectrophotometer. So taking kind of like a snapshot of the elements on the mosses and then seeing if, depending on where they were in Chicago, like how those mosses were essentially taking up elements and what elements they were taking up. This project, I know, again, my best friend in Cozy is totally going to listen to this and he's going to be like, that's my project. So shout out to Incozy because he worked on that project.
Excellent.
So I worked on that. And then with the bryophyte checklist, that was just basically there's all these names, all these taxonomic names, and we want to figure out like what bryophyte species are actually like within an area and which ones are there duplicate names? Is this name being used anymore? Kind of like more taxonomy based, but we ended up finding, I think that there was like 298 bryophyte species in Cook County.
Around the county around Chicago has that many species of mosses and liverworts and hornworts. Is that the last one?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Cool. Yep. Wow. And yes. These, and I love that you use this imagery of a leaf being an eyelash. I mean, I think that really helps set the stage for what these things are and how cool that when you have the list and you figure out how their names and maybe how they're connected, and then using that list to get these signals of what's going on with the environment. Really cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Project and cool people that you're working with and that have helped you get to this place.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I do love my field museum fam. So
that's excellent.
I promise last thing I'll say is that now that bryophyte checklist is being used basically to see how like climate change might be impacting the distribution of these various species. So that's something they're working on now. And I think publishing actually soon.
Very in a cool. Paper.
So yeah.
It's so important to have these mentors and these people that you work with that help you, get different, like you're talking about different views of what a scientist is, how you do work. You've got the jokester. You don't have to, you can do really cool science and you don't have to necessarily be so serious about it. And then you have these other mentors that help you see that you can emulate all these qualities that they see in you. And I know you mentioned earlier, being the first female to go to college and you're in this science profession, in your family. And so I'm just wondering about, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about hurdles, and because there are a lot of hurdles that usually people have to get over and get through and maneuver around in whatever ways possible to get to the place where they are today. And so I'm curious if that idea of you being the first female in your family to go to college, and then this kind of additional layer of that, maybe even beyond your family, of being a female scientist, I'm curious if that was a hurdle for you as you move along your path.
Yeah. I think definitely it's something like, I think, you know, not just me, a lot of women like come up against like in science. I think it's getting better, I will say that, but especially when I was starting, I think for, it's one of those things that's like you want a fine line to walk, because you have to understand where people are coming from, but you also like have to do like what you want, right? Like if I wanted to study trees, like nothing was going to stop me, right, from studying trees, if that's what I really want to do. So I think with my family, you know, now it's something that's they're used to, and like my mom is really supportive of it. Even though like she doesn't, she's like, I don't really get it. but if you want to,
but
do
I still
that,
support
okay.
you. Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. But definitely like at first, when like I guess I first started this journey, it was kind of like, oh, like, you know, like first off, like financially didn't really have funding to go to college. So for a while I wasn't going to go. It wasn't until this is a little bit different than like the female thing, but I wasn't going to go, unless like I got a running scholarship. So I did go to DePaul for a lot of reasons, but I had like a running scholarship that allowed me to go to school. So, I always like, you know, a lot of times people are like, oh, athletes are spoiled. But like, you know, if I didn't have that, I would not have gone to college probably. Yeah. So
the financial piece is definitely another hurdle that comes up often, often in these conversations that, yeah, I mean, you need to have the finances to do a lot of the things that are required in this profession, from training to low paid positions or whatever that is. So yeah, having a way to do that, but then having that extra, those extra activities, on top of all of your various other classes and other, you know, scholastic activities that you were doing as well, and juggling all of that. So yet another hurdle to get over, through, and around.
Yeah. And I think definitely, yeah, again, at first it was kind of like, oh, like you're like, why don't you just do English? Like you're a girl, you should just like write poetry or something, you know?
Yeah.
And there's not like, I actually do like to write poetry, but
you're many faceted human being,
but yeah, but it's like, you know, just because of your gender, I mean, I don't know why that really determines what you would end up doing with your life, unless you really want to do it. And yeah, I think there was definitely kind of like, you know, like you should find like a good partner and like stick with sure. that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So I do think it's, you know, those ideas are definitely like out there, and you, at least in my experience, I've had to kind of be like, you know, just like work past it and work harder to prove that even though I'm a girl, like I'm still smart, or like, right. you know, I still can do these things. So,
yeah. And that this idea of proving yourself, I mean, I think, you know, everybody to some extent feels like they're proving themselves, but I do think that, when maybe there aren't a lot of people that look like you in the thing, doing the thing that you want to do, I think at times it could add another layer of complexity to that feeling and sense that you have to prove yourself, because it also means you have to prove you belong in a place where, yeah, maybe you're just not seeing people that look like you. I was thinking about you having these really amazing role models, and you happen to have mentioned the ones you mentioned were all men. And obviously it doesn't mean you didn't have amazing female role models. And I know you have a female role model in your graduate work that we'll get to, but I'm curious about that. Like, could you, because it sounds like you had a really good encouragement to be like, it doesn't, you belong here. Right. So did you feel like those just having great mentors, regardless of what they looked like, was able to help you navigate through those challenges?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think for me, having positive male role models who are like, you can do it, like, whether you're a girl or like whatever it is, like, you know, we support you in that. I think actually, like, I don't know, for me, hearing it from, I guess, somebody who's not my gender, but like having it be a supportive, more like a supportive role, I actually think was really healthy for me and really helpful. On the other hand, I also felt like, and this was actually partially like, Danielle's awesome in a lot of ways, but like, that was partially one of the things I was like initially really interested in, because I've never had a female boss or advisor, whatever you want to call it, like, honestly, ever. Like, I really, like, that sounds like dramatic, but I really think it's true. And I think it means, I think it can be helpful to have an advisor who is a female, just because they might know like how to navigate a little bit better, and they might understand that struggle a little bit more.
And I don't think you're being dramatic, because I think for many of us, I can share in that statement that you just made, that for a very, very long time, all of my mentors, who were all great and wonderful and helped me a lot, they were all male. And all of my faculty, all of the teachers I had in college and graduate school, you know, for the most part, were male. And there is something, you know, you at least get curious of what, you know, what would it be like? And again, you have a female mentor now, and interesting that you get to have that experience and just see how it's different.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, yeah, they've all been, you know, great. And I think one of the things I've picked up on maybe a little bit is like, I feel like when there are women in like positions of power, quote unquote, if you want to call it that, like, I almost feel it's like they have to try really hard to be like, okay, like, I got everything under control. Like, I'm cool. Like, I'm not stressed. Like, you know, everything's organized. And I'm not sure if like, I just noticed that as like a bias of like, oh, like, she's a woman. Like, I can see like what she's trying to, you know, like trying to be or trying to project. But yeah, I'm sure there's like a lot of complexities that come along with being a woman in a leadership role like that. So,
yeah. And like you said, hopefully, things are changing, changing for the better. And so that these won't be quite such anomalous experiences and, for future scientists moving up in this field and extending that beyond just dimensions of gender and moving into, you know, racial and ethnic dimensions and other aspects of diversity as well. And I think we've made some progress, and we have some more progress to be made in the profession, which is a good to move down a new path and see what that can bring.
Yeah, 100%.
You're listening to today's Voices of Conservation Science. Today, I'm talking with Jessica Harris. She's a graduate student in the Department of Ecology at Montana State University. Okay, so far I've hinted about your research. I've said you have this female faculty mentor here in your graduate program at MSU, but we haven't really touched on what you're working on. So maybe we start out with having you introduce us to your study species.
Yeah. So, okay. So the Ulrich lab, I'm under Dr. Danielle Ulrich, and our lab focuses on high elevation pines. They are sometimes called high five species because they have five needles in their fascicle. So kind of like in a little clump, like a hand, maybe you want to call it that.
A little pine needle hand.
Yeah. And, and these basically high elevation pines, they're most often found in like the subalpine to tree line ecosystem. They can be found like with other forest types, but they're like most well known for being in the subalpine to tree line ecosystem area. And they're a keystone species. They're a foundational species. And so what that means is that keystone species, basically, I guess you could call them like they kind of change the game. Like, they basically create habitat. They provide for other organisms so that all of these other organisms can basically survive in this ecosystem. So specifically, like, the trees that I study are white bark pine and limber pine. So that's, white bark pine is Pinus albicaulis and limber pine is Pinus flexilis. And yeah, like, you know, thinking about the name flexilis, limber, you know,
it's a good name.
Moving a lot. And albicaulis for albi, which is white, and it's white bark. So like from far away, it looks kind of whitish. So that's why, that's where those names come from. And yeah, like basically there's a lot of attention on white bark pine right now. Because as of February of last year, it was listed as threatened via the Endangered Species Act here in the US. And then both limber pine and white bark pine, I believe, are endangered in Alberta. So they're not, you know, they got that federal status of not doing so well. So there's been a lot of attention on them. But white bark pine in particular is a food source for grizzly bears, and is also a food source for Clark's nutcrackers. And there's a lot of organisms that rely on the seed, and basically white bark seed out of all the like high elevation pine conifers actually is like the biggest in mass, and it's really high in fat and has a lot of really good amino acids for birds. So because of that, it's like a major nutrition source for like all of these organisms, and especially in the fall for grizzly bears, it's like their main food source. So
an important time when they're trying to put on fat, getting ready to go into hibernation, looking for every possible nutritional nugget that they can, finding some really, really highly nutritious, highly calorie dense foods is awfully important at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. And definitely true. And the other roles that they are is they help maintain snowpack up on the mountains. So that promotes stream flow like throughout the summer. So generally the snowpack kind of melts off in May or June. And then they also play a major role in preventing like soil erosion and flooding. In addition, this is where they become a foundational species, which means they basically promote the regeneration of other species around them. And because they're the only trees growing on these really high elevations where it's really windy and it's really cold and there's a lot of sun, their presence basically allows other tree species, such as like subalpine fir, for example, to actually establish in those locations. So that's why these like white bark pine, limber pine are so cool, because they have such an important role in the ecosystem.
But clearly there's stuff going on. If you said that they are now, that white bark pine is listed, I'm guessing there's not a lot of, you know, people think of animals being listed under the Endangered Species Act. And maybe we think less about trees or plants or other kinds of organisms being listed. So that tells me that there's some things that are making these very important species not doing so well. And so what are some of those?
Yeah. So they're under four key threats. The first threat would be white pine blister rust, which is actually a non-native fungal pathogen. I'm not going to try to say the scientific name.
That's probably okay.
But basically what it does is that this pathogen comes in through the needles and creates kind of like a canker on the bole or the trunk of the tree. And then everything above that canker is like cut off from water and nutrients, and it dies. And this is really bad for like these older adult trees, who are the ones who are producing cones for reproduction. So we're losing a lot of these adult trees due to white pine blister rust. And white pine blister rust is known to be like the greatest threat to white bark pine and a lot of these other high elevation pines in general. So that's kind of the big one. But the other threats are mountain pine beetle infestations. mostly because with warmer temperatures, they're kind of expanding their range and they're around for longer. We have fire, so like because of fire suppression, we have these lower elevation, more shade tolerant species basically encroaching on this high elevation habitat. And so you think about these high elevation pines who they grow really slow and they live a really long time and they're used to these really tough conditions. And because of that, they're not very good at competing with these other trees and they get out competed essentially. So that's another problem. And the last problem, which is like what my research focuses on primarily, is climate change induced drought and heat stress, which is kind of like a direct effect. Like you have this drought and then after drought, you'll have these mountain pine beetle infestations because the trees are weak and they're like, oh, this is easy prey, right? Like, let's go for it. And then we also have, again, just these trees are weak from drought and it's a lot easier for them to die sooner due to white pine blister rust. So it's kind of like
quadruple whammy.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's all interconnected. So
they're hanging out at these high elevations. You mentioned them being cold places, slow growing, but then we've got these climate changes that are making those places a little bit less cold, or cold for less amounts of time. And then you talked about this sort of heat stress and drought. The changes in the precipitation in addition to changes in temperature. I mean, I think we've often focused on the temperature piece, but changes in rainfall and snowpack and the timing of those things really has been changing as well. And so that you said that's where your focus is, the drought and heat stress.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So I basically, yes, my focus is like on drought, and essentially what's projected is just with greater temperatures, we're going to have greater rates of evapotranspiration. And then there's also probably going to be like the same amount of precipitation. And I'm talking mostly about like Montana and Idaho when I say this stuff, but this is kind of the general forecast that also, so.
Yeah. Different in different places for sure.
Yeah. And essentially my research goes into two different projects. So my first project is focused on seedlings. And then my second project is focused on juveniles. Seedlings are like that age range is from being a germinated individual to being around 2 years old. And then a juvenile is 2 years old to about 20 years old. Since white bark pine can become actively reproductive at 20 years old and up. So that's kind of the different categories, but.
And if you're a slow growing plant, how big can you get when you're two?
This is a great question. Like really, this is kind of what my focus is on. Like I'll be looking at seedling height and stem diameter and all that stuff. Basically, depending on where you're looking at, and within my first project, I'm looking at seeds from Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia. And it's been found that the greatest, or I guess you could say the greatest seedling height is in Northwest Washington. So basically, the farther north you go, you're going to have like colder temperatures or cooler temperatures. And then if you have more precipitation, you're likely to have greater seedling height. So a typical 3-year-old.
Typical. Yeah.
A white bark. I think it was about like 18 centimeters or something.
Wow. Not very big at all.
Yeah. Like not big.
And then you're saying that height is going to vary depending on the conditions, the temperature and precipitation conditions. And that's something you're looking at is how that changes.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. So my research questions are, how do seeds from like originating from different locations of like contrasting climates in Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia, like how are those growth traits and phenology traits different? So specifically I'm basically comparing these seed sources along a precipitation and temperature gradient, looking really at like the Cascades, because west of the Cascades, it's really wet. East of the Cascades, it's really dry. So yeah, that's kind of my first project. And
so is it fair to say that you're talking about differences in the seeds, but then difference in the growing conditions? So maybe some of the variation is due to the seed itself, and some of the variation is due to the conditions in which those seeds grow. And so if you grow this different seeds in the same kinds of conditions, or the same seeds in different kind of conditions, you're looking at how things change.
Okay. I'm really glad you're asking this. So basically my project is going to be comparing populations. Another word that I've been using is seed sources, comparing how those different like populations are varying with their growth traits along these environmental gradients. So, you know, an example might be like, how does seedling height differ for like one of my seed sources from Southeast Oregon, where it's really like relatively warm and doesn't have as much rain? How does that compare to a seed source that's coming from a really wet and really cold part of British Columbia? And when we compare that, and then we put them, like we take all these locations and we take these seed sources, and then we put them into like a common garden. So this is where the greenhouse work comes in. You put all of these different like seed sources in one growing, like common growing environment, you're controlling for that growing environment. And then as you measure the traits, you can see basically how those traits are reflecting those adaptations of that climate of origin. So I might be able to say like, oh, well, you know, seedling height was greater in my British Columbia source compared to my Southeast Oregon source. And one thing that might be related to that is that British Columbia source gets a lot of rain compared to the Southeast Oregon one. So try to understand and piece together like how these different seeds are adapting to their local environment that they're originally from.
So if you had to boil down all of your multiple projects and your different species and your different seed sources, why would you say that the work you're doing is important? What's going to come out of that, of all those comparisons in the end? What are you hoping to be able to learn?
So the main point of this work is ultimately to be able to, one, identify which seeds, I guess, are going to be the most successful when we are outplanting them. So a major restoration strategy is outplanting frost-resistant and stress-tolerant seedlings. So the first thing we want to do is identify like which of these seeds are stress-tolerant and frost-resistant. Mostly like what's happening is you're going to take those seeds and then you're going to put them in a place where you think they're going to do well in the future with climate change. So first off, it's for guiding outplanting efforts. And then secondly, specifically with my project, I'm trying to understand how all of these growth traits are going to be impacting establishment, because that's like the bottleneck or the most challenging time for these seedlings in terms of all of their process.
If they can make it to that place, then they might stand a decent chance of making it all the way.
100%. Thank you. Yeah. Like basically if they can survive emergence and establishment, they're probably going to be okay. They have a pretty good chance of surviving. And so really I want to see how these growth traits might be influencing that establishment stage and recognizing, oh, right, like this family is really good at establishing under various conditions, et cetera. We should outplant that family. And then
seems like that could be useful just to understand, right, for the seeds that are out there in the environment. But also, again, returning back to your other point about restoration, of making sure that as you do these, you try to make the most of these restorations that they're going to be as successful as possible.
Yeah. And in addition to this, like the even bigger picture and looking at growth traits is kind of understanding if this species is growing a lot and this one isn't, I'm going to guess that the one growing a lot might have a competitive advantage over one that's not growing a lot. Or maybe it could be the other way. Like this seed's putting a lot of carbon into being stress tolerant for dealing with really harsh environments. So maybe compared to the one that's not really preparing or not really putting any energy into being stress resistant, you know, maybe I would guess that the more stress tolerant one might survive better in these conditions. So it kind of helps you understand how competition might play out and then how future forest composition might look overall because of those differences in competition, basically.
So if you had to fast forward to the end of your project, what's the most interesting or the most important or the coolest thing that you could discover?
I gotta think about this one.
That's a tough question, I know.
Yeah.
Like, we don't usually get to pick and choose our results. So this is the one shot you get to do that of saying, boy, if I could call this a success, or if the, you know, maybe even not that, but what would be most important?
I think, identifying, I guess, like which populations I'm looking at are best, that would be best at establishing, would be a huge success. And I think the coolest thing to figure out would just probably be that there's more hope than we think, right? For these species. So maybe there's a little bit of give, or there's, more suitable habitat in the future than we think. That'd be really cool. So
yeah, that does seem like that would be a nice outcome, that these threatened species and these ones that have the quadruple whammy, that maybe there is some hope. Okay, so that was a hard question, but maybe the harder question is to ask you about your favorite animal or your favorite plant, or to give you the shot to pick one of each. I feel like you're a pretty plant-oriented person, so I'm curious if there's a if there's one of each, or just a favorite of one.
So I think my favorite tree is hard. I do love eastern white pine because, like, that was my favorite tree growing up, and I also I really like lady slippers, which are not a tree.
Not a tree, but I just said plant. So you're entitled.
Yeah. So I love those. And I think for animal, I worked on a farm for like about 8 or 9 years or so. And like we had pigs. And so I love pigs. I used to have like a little pet pig. At least like I took care of him and he was the runt. So that's probably my favorite animal.
But I love that he was the runt too. That just makes it even better.
Yeah.
Those are great choices. Jessica, thanks so much for taking the time to visit with me today to talk about your plant-filled path and your plant-filled research and your love for little pigs. I wish you the best of luck in your work, and I hope that there's some hope down the line as you continue your work.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
And thanks to all of you for listening to today's Voices of Conservation Science. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you would share an episode with a friend or leave us a review. You can find us all the places that you find your podcasts, places like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Stitcher. And we'd also love to hear from you. We have an email address where you can send us your thoughts about the podcast, or if you have any questions about or for our guests. And that email address is todaysvoices@montana.edu.